Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's Tour Catch-Up.
Brilliant Balter bags a San Diego title.
De Minaur defends his crown in Acapulco.
And Simona Halep is clear to compete once again.
Kim, Chris, today is the 6th of March and we are here to catch up on the week in tennis at Tennis Weekly HQ. Well, it's actually the last 1.5 weeks. Indian Wells is just around the corner. We've got lots of tournaments to catch up on from last week. And because we've delayed our recording, we've got the big breaking news from yesterday. Simona Halep is now free to compete again.
I mean, big, big news. And I mean, if we'd recorded yesterday, we wouldn't have covered it. So we're bringing you all the hot topics and all the legal side of it a bit later.
Chris, you basically used all our prep time to just basically talk about this case. And I'm really excited to hear what you say later on, because it's just opened up a complete can of worms, hasn't it, in the tennis community?
I haven't even asked you two how you are. I just started talking as soon as we joined.
Yes.
This about,
oh my god,
you're straight into it.
Halep news.
I have thoughts. Yeah. And I have questions, I think is how I started it.
We know this is a passionate area for you,
it
Chris.
Is indeed. Yes,
but it is fascinating. I just thought
Kim wanted to be more lighthearted and just talk about, oh, it was so nice to see the Netflix slam and Rafael Nadal back on TV.
Not if I have
well,
my way.
Well, I did think we were going to open with that, you know. I mean, my favorite thing from the last week in the world of tennis has definitely been seeing Rafa back in action at the Netflix slam. Make of the Netflix slam what you will, we'll get onto that later, but I loved seeing especially his baby
so
Rafa
sweet.
There you know, the whole family were there. It was lovely to see scenes with baby Rafa. And I also loved the very American intro when he came onto the court. They were very much like Rafael Nadal. And I haven't quite heard that pronunciation of his name before, but it definitely went with the vibe of the event, shall we say.
It harks back to the Djokovic. Like, I think a lot of
the Djokovic.
There was a lot of that that used to happen.
Carlos as well.
Yeah, very Americanized. But I mean, Kim, you've got to say, as a preview, did Nadal do you justice? Of course you were watching, but are you optimistic?
Yes. I mean, I think he generally did all right, considering we haven't seen him in a while.
You always not over egg things when it comes to, don't want to jinx it.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, it just depends on if he gets drawn into long matches, who he's facing. He doesn't have a great draw at Indian Wells, I don't think. So, I mean, that will come in the second half. But I thought generally, yeah, it was a fun event to have on Netflix. But I, you know, something different. I don't think this is the future of tennis, but others may beg to differ.
No one wheeled off court. Everyone still standing by the end.
Everyone was still safe and standing. There was a moment where someone in the audience had a bit of an issue, but that was
it was doomed.
That was
yeah,
quickly
exactly.
resolved. Yeah. but yeah, I mean, what else has been happening? There's been quite a lot going on this week. Obviously, loads of tennis to get our teeth into. There was something quite amusing that came out of the Indian Wells draw, which we will be getting onto later. And it involves a certain former French number one, doesn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes. Former French number one, because Hugo Humbert's just gone on an absolute... His form's just gone skyrocketed, hasn't it? And he, I think, is now
top
at the
15,
top of the tree.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's impressive. But yeah, Mannarino, I don't know if you guys clocked this, but on social media, there was a bit of a faux pas by one of the main tennis outlets in tennis Twitter. I'm not going to name names, but they posted the draw... And they got the draw slightly wrong because they had Mannarino defeated by defeated Mannarino, who was seeded into the second round. Very, very impressive result. Didn't even need to step on the court. So I don't know if Bai is going to be one to watch for the rest of the season.
Will they be? Yeah,
yeah, very good. Very good scalp in Manorino.
Will Bai be ranked by the end of the year? Who knows? The French number one.
What happens if a player actually genuinely has Bai as their surname?
Baez.
Would they have to rename Bai?
Yeah. I don't know. But Manorino would be maybe a bit fearful. But yeah, no, it was a little bit of a mix up. And I just thought it was quite funny just seeing the sort of the head to head. Maybe we can have some head to heads in the future of players versus buys. Yeah.
I hope there's not a foreshadowing that he's going to, you know, withdraw.
Maybe players should take out their aggression on buys rather than line judges as well.
Very true.
Ooh. Fighting talk.
Yeah. And Chris, what's been your highlight of the last week?
Well, I obviously loved the fact that Katie Boulter and Alex de Minaur had fantastic weeks. The couple both picked up titles.
The power couple of tennis.
They really are. I think we all thought it might be Sitsidosa, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, move over, Tsitsipas. Yeah. Bedosa and also Gem's life.
Gem's, oh, well,
she
true.
Is the power. What has the power to from Gem's Leicester life? As
they
well.
Don't, I still they think, don't post as much, but no, I still follow them.
If Gem's life posted more, I would personally probably say they are still the power couple, but the power it couple at the moment, you're right, it's Boulter and de Minaur.
It is on the tennis court. I actually have a WhatsApp group I'm a part of, which is called Gem's Life, years ago when we went to Wimbledon one time. I shouldn't admit to that. But I love the fact that Alex played his match, finished around midnight, skipped the players' party, completely bounced, which I believe in Mexico must be some sort of a crime to miss the party after you've won the title. And then he got a 4:30 a.m. taxi for a 6 a.m. flight just so he could see Katie in the final. And then she gave him a shout out afterwards just to embarrass him for it. But she said she appreciated it. But, you know, that is commitment. Tennis players and... There's no rest, and I'm not sure that's the perfect preparation for Indian Wells losing all that sleep.
I think what this means is I know there's Gem's life, but maybe there needs to be an ACDBUM life.
Ooh.
ADMKB, like, is
yeah,
that what
you're
trying to say?
That was what I was trying to go with. It's very snappy.
Adam Kabur.
Badum. Mm. No.
How about...
That's hard, isn't it?
Kabadoom.
Yeah, we can make it work.
Give us a funky make it work. Name.
The Boulters? No.
Oh, that sounds... They sound quite fancy,
they do.
Don't they?
Yeah,
DeBaulters.
They're coming over.
Yeah,
get like a nice that. Bottle out.
I mean, he definitely gets, you know, boyfriend brownie points for his antics there, getting to the airport to go to San Diego.
Thank goodness she
to
won.
To see her win. It must have been very motivating to have him there to, you know, you definitely want to make sure it's worth his while coming there. And she didn't have it easy because she was a set down in that final in San Diego to Marta Kostic, who was the much higher ranked and seeded player. But she came back in storming fashion, 5-7, 6-2, 6-2. So this is only her second WTA title. She previously won the WTA 250 in Nottingham. But obviously this is, you know, twice as big in terms of ranking points available. So, yeah, probably the absolute highlight of her career, I think it's fair to say. Chris, how impressive did you find Katie Boulter's tennis last week?
I was hugely impressed. I think there's been a lot of talk about the improvements that she's making to her game, the change in her mentality, the fact that she really does think she's able to do something more and push on. And I think there were question marks. Last year, winning the 250 was great, but she didn't play a player. I think it was inside the top 130, whereas this week, it's been four players in the top 40, and players that you think could be very tricky for her. I mean, there are big hitters, there are players that really grind out the points, and there's also, you know, there's a player who's a fantastic mover that's going to get every ball back in court, and Marta Kostic in the final. So she had all manner of opponents thrown at her, and the hitting was unbelievable. I've never seen her move that well. And it just feels like she's loving her time on the court and it's bringing out the best in her game. And all the work that she's done is paying off. And I mean, what an achievement to be world number 27 going into Indian Wells. It's huge. It really is huge for her and for British tennis.
Yeah, I mean, she beat Kostic in the final, Emma Navarro as well, Donovekic, Haddad Maia, who was the second seed in San Diego, and she also beat Lesia Sorenko. So like you said, I think dismissing those naysayers who said last year, oh, you know, yes, she got a title, how strong was the field, etc. And also, you know, that was on home soil, grass courts, where she, you know, perhaps feels more comfortable. But this is, you know, different environment completely. And she's, up into the top 30, breaking new ground. Really fantastic. I mean, it's the first British female to have won a title of this level since Jo Konter in 2017. So has been a while, with the exception of Emma Raducanu winning the US Open. I mean, just on the subject of Emma Raducanu, if Bolter was to play Raducanu tomorrow, for example, who's winning that one? We going Katie Bolter?
I think on the form at the moment, you have to go with Katie Bolter. She really is on an upwards trajectory at the moment. And I think for me, the thing is, I feel like I know this talent and this capability is within her. We just haven't necessarily seen it in such a consistent fashion as we have seen, I think, in San Diego. And I think that's what's been so impressive, is the fact that she's been able to kind of string these performances together and take out some really top level players with top rankings. And I do think, you know, she's the British number one at the moment, and she's not going to let that go. And I think she can go even further up the rankings. And I was going to ask you both, I mean, in terms of kind of looking, not necessarily at Emma Raducanu, but as you mentioned, Kim, someone like Jo Konter. I mean, Jo Konter, her career high was what, 4 in the world? Yeah. She got to semi-finals at Grand Slams. I don't think Katie Bolter necessarily is in that conversation at the moment, but how close do you think Bolter can get to a conversation, a credible conversation in the realms of Jo Konter?
Oh, that's a big question. I think the difficulty that there's always kind of been is the consistency. And she does have great weeks. There are also weeks when she might miss more than she wants to as well, because she does go for her shots. And that's the part of her game. You know, she has had some losses to players that you'd think maybe she would beat. You know, she's had some kind of at the end of last year, like in Korea against Kaya Yuvan, Anna Bogdan in Adelaide. And then she has had these kind of outstanding results against players, you know, at different stages. So, for example, here, and then just had some good results elsewhere. So it's a case where at the moment it's big weeks with big impacts, and in between there are lulls. So I think if she's able to be more consistently on the tour with this ranking, she can get to any tournament she wants. That will really help her ranking. So she's only going to get higher before the summer is what I'd say. There will be opportunities to play big tournaments that she didn't have last year as well. So I'd say we're looking top 20 is very realistic. I'm not sure whether we'd go kind of top 15, but I think top 20 is realistic. Kim, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think if she can stay in the seedings for Wimbledon, that would be fantastic. I think that's a real, like, kind of more shorter term goal, just to kind of have that consistency, get those ranking points. Like you said, she can get into some tournaments she wouldn't have been able to get into automatically previously, which is a big benefit that you want to make the most of. And I think it's refreshing to have her up there, because for so long the conversation's been around Emma Raducanu, and I think actually that was getting a bit stale. You know, we'll need to give her time to kind of regroup and improve, but let's focus on Bolter and what a brilliant player, you know, she is showing at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. I think we should just, you know, cherish what she, you know, what she's doing at the moment on the tennis court. And I think what's kind of interesting, you talked about, you know, she's now in a position where she should be getting seedings, you know, potentially for Grand Slams. And she's almost transitioning, I think, to one of these players who players don't want to be facing, you know, in the first or second round. She's almost like the hunter, as it were, to these kind of big players looking for those big upsets. And the higher she goes up the rankings, she's going to become more of the, you know, the hunted. She's almost going to kind of go into some matchups as the favourite. So I think it'll be very interesting to see how that kind of flip and how she adjusts to that, where she's going to walk out on court and actually she's going to be the one with the target on her back.
She has been the underdog and she does like that, you know, playing for her country against very high ranked players. She always loves that. She loves the challenge. We've seen that, you know, against players like Pliskova on the grass. She caused absolute kind of all kinds of trouble for her. So that's a great point, because this time last year she was 151 in the world. So it's been a very steep rise. And I think that's where it maintaining that is the real challenge, because as you say, now there will be expectations that weren't there even 6 months ago.
I mean, her boyfriend, as we've discussed, Alex de Minaur, won the Acapulco event. Actually, I think he has previously won this event as well. So he's successfully defended the title there. He loves the courts out in Acapulco. Straight sets over Casper Ruud in the final, 6-4, 6-4. Obviously, de Minaur's been in pretty good form this year, so it kind of continues that. But one thing we must talk about is the fact that despite both winning 500 level titles, the prize money they each received was considerably different, which is something that we have pointed out on social media. It got a lot of traction, a lot of engagement. How is this acceptable in 2024?
It is mad. It's mad.
It's not acceptable.
It isn't acceptable, right? I was just looking at the draws, as I want to do. I like to look at the prize money, the points. I like to look at what the cutoff point was for entry. And I just thought, you know what? Let's just have a look at this, because San Diego in the US, you'd think, would have a pretty good prize pot. Acapulco, I mean, is a staple on the ATP tour, so it is very, very well known. But the difference was $412,555 for Alex and $142,000 for Katie. And so Casper also made $80,000 more than Katie. So, I mean, Joel, how does this happen? Is it to do with management of WTA? That's what a lot of suggestions were about, or?
Absolutely. I think unfortunately, it's a testament to how bad a shape I think the WTA is in at the moment. And, you know, we're going to talk in the second half about, you know, Saudi Arabia and their influence and you know, new partnership with the ATP that's going to bring in, you know, money there, and it's going to help, you know, bolster those, you know, prize funds, you would imagine, and also probably help players, you know, further down the rankings compete and have a life on the tour. But it's just going to create an even starker contrast, I think, to the WTA. Unless they get their act together and think about, well, how can we get more money in? And I know there's going to be difficult conversations there around Saudi Arabia because of big players like Billie Jean King, Martina Navratilova, and they're purely, you know, against that. But I just think the way that WTA has been managed over the years, this is a situation we're ending up in, and it's just becoming starker and starker, and it's getting, quite frankly, just too ridiculous.
It's night and day, isn't it, really, in terms of what's happening here. But thankfully, I did check the Indian Wells draw, and it is 100% equal, despite the fact that there is the Saudi investment and the logos are already appearing. For the Masters, it is not affecting the prize money in a negative way for the WTA, which is always good to see.
I mean, yeah, it's a bit of an embarrassing situation that isn't replicated in terms of equal prize money across the whole tour. And perhaps, you know, do you sell your soul to the Saudi Arabians to get that prize money in place?
I mean, Kim, you know, as a woman, would you, if it's going to mean equal prize money, would you do the deal with the devil, as it were, that some people might think? Or would you rather...
Would you do a Rafa?
Would you rather kind of keep your innocence and stay away from that, but know that inequality is going to exist?
I would put a vote to the players. What do the players want? I'm sure they probably would want more prize money. I'm sure morally some of them would object to Saudi Arabia, but at the end of the day, they need to fund their careers and have an existence. Yeah. So I would put it to them and let the majority decide.
It's tough, and it's interesting because I was watching some of the athletics, things like the World Indoor Championships at the moment, and the prize money there is also dreadful. Like people are winning gold medals and only winning like $40,000 or whatever. And I think Josh Kerr, the British athlete, basically said, I would have Saudi Arabia come in and invest if it's going to mean that more prize money. So perhaps it is a player conversation and a player vote to kind of push it through potentially.
I would have liked a stance from the ATP that wasn't to take the money. I think it puts the WTA in a very difficult situation, and we will obviously talk about this in a bit more detail in the second half. But then as the disparity gets bigger, there's more pressure, especially, for example, from athletes, as you've mentioned, to reduce that deficit that exists there, especially because women's tennis is the number one women's sport in the world. And it doesn't look good when it plays second fiddle. So if there was a joint management, we talked about this before, then I think it would make for a better situation where it wouldn't be the WTA having to make a deal with Saudi Arabia. It would be tennis as opposed to the Women's Tennis Association.
I wonder what the PTPA is doing about this as well. I mean, that seems to have gone a bit quiet, hasn't it?
Well, they're not quiet on Halep. I can tell you what they think about that.
Well, okay. I mean, let's also look at what else we saw in Acapulco. Casper Ruud obviously losing in that final to Alex de Minaur. Casper Ruud has a bit of a difficulty in finals that are not 250 events. He's not won one. He's 0-6 in his career. And he's only even just won one of the sets in those finals. What is it about a level above a 250 that he just can't get over.
I think it tends to be on hard courts. And his best surface is obviously clay. He's very good on hard. He hasn't had the best results last year, that's for sure. So I think it's probably down to that more than it is anything else. You know, he's made semi-finals on clay. He's made finals of Masters on hard courts as well. So that is obviously a great result in itself. And, you know, some of the players he's lost to have been pretty handy. I mean, Alex de Minaur right now is playing the tennis of his life. And probably the only player who's performing better on the tour is Jannik Sinner. So I wouldn't be too harsh on this defeat. Some of the ones previously, maybe he hasn't made the best effort in finals. You know, some of the Grand Slam finals he's had haven't been the most competitive. But this one, it was a kind of a great week, and it was a very competitive two sets. Just Alex de Minaur was just a cut above.
Before we move on, I will just say, I honestly thought this was going to be Jack Draper's first title
Jack
on the tour.
Jack Acapulco was looking good.
He was looking very, very good. He took out Ketmanovic, and I was wondering, why didn't he do that in the Davis Cup, Kim, when we were there? And it was like those really hard going. But yeah, he retired against de Minaur in the semis. I think it was more of an illness retirement as opposed to an injury. So he is set to play in Indian Wells, and he is getting closer and closer. But yeah, some of the ruthlessness he has, particularly in the earlier rounds, is very encouraging. The fact that he can spend so little time on court. I mean, he bageled Nishioka. He bageled Tommy Paul in the first round, 6-love, 6-4. To get through those rounds with minimal fuss, it really does help, I think, when you get kind of into the sharper end of an event. And it feels like just a matter of time. But yeah, sad it wasn't in Acapulco.
11 games to make the semifinals. I've just done some mental maths there. That is very, very impressive. And then taking a set off de Minaur when you're not feeling your best, I mean, that's also something to be pretty pleased with and to take something from, as opposed to kind of focus on the fact that you had to pull out.
Jack Acapulco will happen at some point.
Until he wins it, he has to keep going back.
Any tournament he's in now, I'm just going to try and figure out how can we get Jack in the title.
Indian Wells, please have a go.
Okay, I'll come back to you.
Yeah.
Japan Open in Tokyo, maybe? No, that's
okay,
a bit now.
We could try. Yeah.
Well, we also had Dubai, which was another ATP 500. And another player who's done very well this year is Hugo Humbert, the current French number one. He claimed another title, this time in straight sets over Alexander Bublik. I guess what's most notable is that Hugo Humbert has just continued his considerable prowess in an ATP final. He's now 6-0. He's never lost a final. And he's now in the top 15 in the ranking. So, you know, a bigger title for him to go along with the one he won recently, and a highest ranking for him as well. And, you know, he definitely earned his title this week, beating Medvedev, beating Hercash, and then obviously Bublik in the final. Really, really impressive. Where can he go from here? You know, is he just going to kind of continue this rise? Or where's his ceiling, do we think, Joel?
Oh, it's an interesting one, because he's similar to kind of Katie Balter in terms of where he was a year ago to where he is now. You know, he's brought Jeremy Shardy on as his coach. And I mean, at the moment, Chris, Jeremy Shardy is almost like a miracle worker.
He's not with him. He was in France at a challenger that he was running this last
week.
That's
his magic, maybe.
Maybe that is that's the way he works.
Yeah,
miracles.
He likes time
it's
apart.
Coaching by Zoom.
Yeah.
But everything about Humbert's game over the last 12 months, it feels like it has improved. You know, he's got more aggressive. His shots are deeper. I've really enjoyed what he's been doing with his backhand. And yeah, in the final, you know, Alexander Bublik just didn't really have an answer to it. And I personally think, you know, why not? He can push into maybe kind of the, you know, Cam Norrie territory of, you know, maybe just shaving into the, you know, into the top 10 potentially. I thought it was interesting, Chris, you said you think Alex de Minaur probably has had the, maybe in terms of form, is the form player after Jannik Sinner. Mm. I personally don't think Hugo Humbert's that far behind him. It may even be above de Minaur in some people's books.
He isn't far behind at all. I think it's a very, very close in terms of how they're playing and what their performance has been like. I think the thing that edges it for me is that victory over Djokovic. and the performance at the slams. I think we haven't seen Humbert go deep at a slam yet. I think sometimes the occasion has got to him. But I remember last year in Manchester, Dibinar made the quote basically saying that on his day, he can hit like the number one in the world, basically, about Humbert. And I think that we were all a bit taken aback by that. I think we mentioned that.
We looked at each other being like, did he just say
really?
That?
Yeah, we'll listen back and check. But he did. And I think there's obviously a lot of respect for just how big a hitter he is. And when he's on, as we've talked about, you said the comparison to Katie Bulter, it really is on. And when it's not necessarily working as well as he'd like, it can be a bit messy. So, yeah, I mean, Kim, if you had to decide between us, if I'm saying it's Dibinar, Joel's saying Humbert, well, who's going to edge it? You can say someone else.
Well, I'd love to see Humbert spring a surprise at, you know, one of the Masters.
Well, I might have predicted that, Kim.
Coming up. Ooh, spoiler.
Kim, I know you spoke about his record in finals and it being 6-0. There are two other players. He's only become the third man ever in the Open era to win his first 6 ATP Tour finals. The two other players, I don't know whether to kind of laugh or cry at this, but they are...
Are they not household names
then,
Joel?
It's not Felix O'Shaughnessy, definitely not.
They're household names to us. They're household names to us. And maybe to some of our listeners. Ernest Gulbis and Martin Kleizan. What?
I didn't know either of them had got 6 titles. That's
harsh.
That's impressive. Well, yes. God, Kleizan must have sort of racked those up like ad hoc without anyone noticing.
Over a long career,
that
maybe,
a bit
yeah.
Harsh.
Goodness.
Yeah. Oh, blimey. Well done, Humbert. I don't know between Alex Dibinar and Humbert. I feel like on his day, I think Humbert might edge it for me.
Ooh, okay.
But we will see. I mean, he might very well have played a different person in the final, because Bublik had a very interesting semi-final with Rublev. They were deep in the throes of a third set after two tiebreak sets when Rublev got defaulted for swearing at a line judge. He was defaulted for unsportsmanlike conduct. He was then given a lot of penalties as a result, loss of prize money for the tournament, loss of rankings points, etc. And, well, there was a bit of hoo-ha after that, obviously. We don't often see players being defaulted, so when it does happen, it's quite a talking point. Interestingly, some of those penalties have been, like, rescinded. He's now only just paying the code violation fine after he's appealed it, so that is a fine of £28,700. But what do you both make of this? Do you think this was it a warranted default? Do you think the official was too harsh? Or do you think Rublev deserved what he got?
I personally, I've seen a lot about this. I've been engaging with Twitter. I've been subtweeting.
Davidic, what hill are you dying on, Chris?
I always have an opinion, Joel, and I firmly believe his behaviour was unacceptable. I think that when it comes to what was said on the court, I think that maybe he didn't swear. I mean, I can't tell. I wasn't there. So I think that the language side of things is also, to be honest, is secondary to swearing at someone versus swearing. Because we see, I talk about this a lot, Andy Murray is swearing constantly on the tennis court, never gets a violation. Players can swear, but not get violations all the time. So I do think there is an argument on that. But for me, the way that he aggressively approached that that lines judge and was very, very threatening in his face, I did not think was acceptable. It did remind me of Serena Williams. And the incident where she got defaulted with the line judge there. The line judge said that she said that she would ram the ball down the throat. Serena said she didn't say that. Very, very similar in that sense. But I think ultimately, Rublev was a ticking time bomb. We've seen it before multiple times where he has displayed this sort of behavior. And it was only a matter of time before something like this got more serious. And I personally think that that's my biggest issue, is that you aren't penalizing somebody if you're getting a fine of 37,000 whilst having your prize money of over 130,000 reinstated. And the final thing I'll say on the hill that I'm dying on, Joel, is if I was in Andre Rublev's PR team, I would have started with, I'm very sorry to the lines person for the way that I spoke to him, but I'm very pleased with the result of this, that I did not swear, did not violate the code conduct. but he doesn't mention them at all. He doesn't apologise to the lines person. He just says that he will try to be a better player and a better person. I'm not sure it's about being a better player. It's just about behaving in a way that is acceptable on a tennis court, because if that's what you do when cameras are on, imagine what you do when cameras are off.
Well, we saw at the UTS where there are no rules and you can't get defaulted for having a rant at people. He was very aggressive.
It was worse, I think, at UTS, I would say.
It was really long. It was minutes. It was probably about 10 minutes of just shouting at people. He climbed the umpire's chair and shouted at the umpire. Mm. And I think the audience thought it was amusing at the first and then realised this was something completely different. He did apologise for that as well. And we did ask him about that in Oslo, and he apologised and said that the behaviour was not acceptable. So I don't think he thinks the behaviour is acceptable, but with this one, Joel, what's your main takeout?
I think, you know, there is that kind of curve, I think, that exists on the internet of, like, you mess around, you find out, and the more you mess around, the more likely you are to find out. And I think in this match, he messed around, and he found out in terms of getting a default. However, I personally don't think it was an automatic default. I think it was more in a... I agree that there should have been a penalty, but I don't necessarily think it was a default worthy moment. And I think what kind of flummoxed me the most was Alexander Bublik afterwards on the court was like, I'm happy to play on. Like, he didn't feel like it was necessarily that bad. And I'm a little bit on that side. But if it leads to Rublev, you know, having better behavior on the court, then I'm all for it, because I do think this could be a wake-up moment for him, because he's such a feisty competitor. There is absolutely no way he would have wanted to walk off the court at, you know, 6-5 in the third set with, you know, an ATP 500 final on the line. So if there's good that can come of it, I'm for it. But, you know, when I was looking at it on TV, I'm not gonna lie, I wasn't 100% sure.
If someone yelled at me like that in a professional environment, I would hope that they would be either suspended from or given a period of time off where they should not be around, or I think they should be let go, because I do think it was that level of, you cannot speak to people like that and you cannot speak to lines people like that. And I think I understand why you might get angry if you don't think that something has been done that's wrong. It's big for you. It's your career. These people might not do this every week. Sometimes they're hired locally. Who knows? But I do just think the manner of how you speak to people is the big issue for me here. And I think in other professions, that would be enough to get you defaulted.
Yeah, I mean, this is their place of work, for the player and the line judge. And I think that's a really good comparison, Chris, because why should sport be any different? You should still treat people in a professional manner with respect. And, you know, why do they sort of, certain people, I'm not saying everyone in sport feels like this, but there is a cohort of people who probably think they might be above sort of the rules of everyday,
or above the lines,
workplaces and just everyday morals. Yeah, it's, I mean, I think I agree with the original decision. I think it was right to be defaulted, right to give him that level of violation and you know, penalty. I know there's an argument that they didn't use like a video replay to check what was happened before defaulting. So yeah, there's arguments to be had whereby you could have a kind of review process before making that decision. Certainly lots of interesting points raised.
That point is interesting around the replay. That's also what was asked at UTS as well. And I think if it was me and I had behaved badly like that, I would want people to know that I didn't say what was being said. I think that is important. And then it's just, you can take it at face value for the way that it was done. So I do understand that, but...
I don't agree with the way the process that was done.
So messy.
It just looked like the supervisor came on court, you know, almost kind of to me, like, was just like, I've got all the power here, I'm going to make the decision. Mm. And the decision was on, it wasn't clear, because to me it was like, you know, one thought he was saying in Russian, other one was saying it was in English, and it didn't feel definitive. And he was siding with his line judge, which, I don't know, it didn't feel fair unless he had viewed a replay first to make, you know, 100% certain.
I agree. It was very, very strange. And I think that people yell at their box like that all the time, and they might just get a warning if you think they said something, and then they move on. I think the issue is where this was focused on. And as you say, we've seen a few of these. Let's hope that he does live to what he said of being a better player and a better person.
He's got to live up to his brand's values. He's play playing, for the kids.
The children.
Yeah, play for the kids.
For the children,
yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Play for the children and don't play for the lines people is definitely, that's definitely not his t-shirt.
Yes. Well, let's have a look at the other two tournaments we had last week, one of which was in Chile at ATP 250. I think this is the end of the Golden
Indeed.
Swing, which is
sad times.
Very
Get
sad.
The violin out.
Yes.
Very sad for Golden Swing fans. But Sebastian Baez has finished his Golden Swing with a bang, picking up another title, this time defeating Alejandro Tabilo in three sets in the final, coming from a set down 3-6, 6-love, 6-4. So two titles in 2 weeks for Sebastian Baez, because he also won last week in Rio. He's now up into the top 20 of the rankings as well. So a lot of players moving up to career highs this week.
I think he's Argentinian number one now. I think he's overtaken Cerundolo.
Yeah, he must be.
Exactly. And yeah. I think he's also going into Indian Wells in the race, I believe at number six, which is equal number five with Andre Rublev. They've got the same number of points. And that was not on my bingo card. I've got to be honest. I think I was not expecting that. And I think it'd be very interesting to see, you know, we've got the clay swing coming up after this and see how he does. But I mean, it's very impressive that he is able to do what so many players who enter the 250s aren't able to do, which is pick up regular titles. A lot of players drop down.
He's not the most imposing player on the tennis court, but he certainly makes the most of it. And especially in front of all the Chilean fans, I mean, the main takeout I got from this tournament was they were so desperate. Whenever a Chilean stepped on the tennis court, they were not happy with their opponent. I don't know if you saw Mute.
Oh, yeah.
Mute versus Jarry. Jarry was the top seed.
Very
and Mute
spicy.
Came through in two sets. And he was just lording it up. And
I think, yeah, he started with an ace with an underarm serve.
Yes.
And that
yes.
will not win the crowd over for you. So I'm kind of with them a little bit. But I think he's... I think he should play the Golden Swing every year because he's made quite the impact from all sorts has been going on.
I mean, they've got some fun crowds down in the Golden Swing. So I think, it's great atmosphere at a lot of the events there. And as Alina attested to in Buenos Aires, I mean, Sebastian Baez becomes the first player to win multiple titles during the Golden Swing since 2020. Can you name the player who did it in 2020, either of you?
We just had this, didn't we? I set
we had this
for
on a
you.
Par for the court, so it should be fresh
it's be team.
In our minds. Dominic Thiem? No, it's know. Not.
Francisco Cerundolo?
No, it is actually
Juan Manuel Cerundolo.
Christian Garin.
Oh, okay.
Who is Chilean, right? Yes, he is. Baez, though, another player doing well this year, 16-5 on the year. I know a lot of that is from the Golden Swing, but can he transfer that to the European clay?
He That'll just wants Roland Garros to happen next week.
I mean,
yeah, just live on the clay.
He's got a good
all
seeding.
The time.
I'm also making a note of this on the script that we have here to put this in our end of year quiz. This question needs to come up again to see if we get it all wrong as to who was the last person to do
we
it.
We probably will.
We will, exactly.
Eagle-eyed listeners, note that now for the end of season quiz. But finishing off the last week's roundup of tournaments, we also had the ATX Open in Austin, which was a WTA 250. This was an all-Chinese final. We had Yuan Wei up against Wang Zhizhu, and that went the way of Yuan. 6-4, 7-6, straight sets. To get her first career title. So an all-Chinese affair out in Austin. Chris, did you watch much of this over the past week? Or, you know, probably not the event that was on the foremost of everyone's
mind. Chris clocked
mind.
Out when Sloane Stephens went out in the second round to Sevastova.
I mean, Sevastova, that was also very interesting that she's back and she's obviously playing well. This is her biggest win since her comeback. But no, I think there's a lot of Chinese players who are clearly kind of the generation that was inspired by Na Li who are coming up. We've obviously got Qin Wen Zheng performing very well. And there's a real pack of players behind her who are also really putting it together. And slightly surprising in terms of this result. I mean, a lot of us wouldn't have picked an all-Chinese final over in the States. I think we've kind of seen a lot more of this on the men's side where you have kind of a 250 in the US and it is an all-American affair. It's almost a rite of passage. So again, very, very impressive to come through, but completely out of the blue because, I mean, the season hasn't been great so far. She did make the semifinals in Hobart So maybe that was a taste of things to come, and did make the final at the end of the year in a ITF 100 in Japan. So moving up the rankings, and kind of moving from, you know, the ITF tour to picking up a title on the WTA tour. So a player who is kind of pushing on, at a good time of her career at the age of 25.
Yeah, just the better player on the day, sort of stats wise. And it was, yeah, like you said, it's unusual for it to be on American soil. It's actually the first all Chinese final to be taking place outside of Asia since 2006.
Don't test us
so
on who
very
they were.
Many years ago. Well, you mentioned one of them earlier.
Okay. Another Chinese player. Is it Peng Shuai? Would it be? No,
it was not. It was Lina, who you mentioned, and another player who was sort of around that era. Oh. Had a big upset at Wimbledon over Ivanovic.
Zheng Ji,
yeah. So they played the final in Estoril in 2006.
Estoril, goodness,
yes.
Wow.
You'll be going there,
yeah,
soon,
I will,
believe,
yes,
Chris,
indeed,
for the tennis.
Hopefully, they'll both be there still.
But we did also have another British winner on the WTA tour, not just Katie Balter. We had Olivia Nichols winning the doubles title in Austin with her partner Olivia Gadecki of Australia. So yeah, it was an all unseeded final, but they came through in straight sets, so that's their first title together. But yeah, great for Olivia Nichols, her second doubles title overall, first with Gadecki. So well done. We're going to take a very quick break now, but do join us in the second half, where we'll be discussing the news that Simona Halep is able to play tennis once again. Saudi Arabia striking up a new strategic partnership with the ATP. And we'll also be unveiling our predictions for Indian Wells. So do not go anywhere.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to the Tennis Weekly podcast. And now we are going to move on to our quiz section for the week, which is one that we did a few months ago, and we are resurrecting it.
By popular demand.
Namely, Joel is resurrecting
demand,
it. And it is yeah. Joel's game.
Joel's game is back. Very, very exciting. I've been looking forward to this all week.
I'm not sure I have, Kim.
for everyone who can't remember or like, what on earth is Joel's game? What's he on about? This is how it works. So guys, I am going to give you and our listeners a player, and I'm going to tell you their career high ranking. And then I'm going to give you another player, and you're going to tell me quite simply whether that person's career high ranking is higher, lower, or the same.
Okay.
And the idea is to get 5 correct answers in a row. And if you do that together, you have completed and won Joel's game.
Okay. I sort of remember this.
I'm ready.
But we're working together, are we, Kim?
We're working together. So
oh,
I can't
nice.
Lose
this is
week.
Very, we can lose, well, we can well, lose together.
You can't beat me. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah.
We can still lose.
Okay, so the player I'm starting with is Katerina Siniaková.
Oh, good Lord.
Just out of interest, what do you think her career high ranking is?
37?
I honestly don't know. I think it would be around the 40 mark as well. I'd say 41 maybe.
Oh, Kim's closer. It's actually 31.
So, there you go. We're not off to a great start then, are we?
So that's your that is your starting point, and for our listeners as well, 31.
Mm-hmm.
So the player I'm going to give you next is
Safulin. No,
Lesia Sorenko.
Okay.
So is Lesia Sorenko's career high ranking higher, lower, or same?
I think she had a period where she was ranked higher. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, she's definitely was seeded at a slam like once or twice, wasn't she? Like 27th seed.
I think she had a moment. I think she's probably been top 25.
Yeah, I'd say around that.
That was the gut response.
Yeah. Higher, please, Joel.
That is correct. Yes, Sorenko has gone higher. 23 in 2019.
Nice.
So good on her.
So that's your new position. You got one correct answer. The next player I'm going to give you is Alia Tomjanovic.
So she has been very unlucky. This is where I do know some things, where the points didn't count for Wimbledon. She made two consecutive quarterfinals and then she got injured. So I think she might have got very close to top 20. But maybe didn't go higher than that because of it.
I mean, she's been a big star of Breakpoint, isn't she? Like, a lot of focus on her. And I'm just trying to think, did they mention...
I remember watching the rankings thinking, will she get her top 20 debut? Oh, that is tricky, isn't it?
Do we think she's been about 26, but like 24? Oh, do you think she's ever so slightly lower?
I'm being silly. I remember this now. I worked out if she had the Wimbledon points, she would have made her top 20 debut. So I think it's lower.
I'm going to have to I want an answer. I'm going to push you.
I think lower.
I think it's lower. 27 or something, yeah. Lower, please, Joel.
That is a correct answer, yes. Tomjanovic,
well done,
career high 32 in 2023. So you did very well there. Okay, so two correct answers. The next player I'm going to give you, Monica Pui.
I mean, she won the Olympics.
But that's
about
all she won,
higher,
I think.
Lower or same than career high 32.
Lower, I think. I mean, surely.
This is tough, isn't it? Because I don't really know. I can't name good, particularly good results that she's had.
No.
But then at the same time, Joel will throw in a sneaky one, you know.
Could it be the same?
Could be the same.
Is this the sneaky?
I'm putting my best poker face on. We are recording on video, and I'm doing my best poker face.
He's really not giving us anything, and I'm really trying to read into it. I actually have no idea on this one at all.
I think she could have been slightly lower, but like 35 max. I would say lower.
I'm not sure she went top 30, so I'd agree with you. We'll say it. We'll if we're in it together, Kim.
Yeah, all right.
We're not that confident,
lower,
are
please,
we?
Lower, Joel.
Lower?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is incorrect.
Oh, no.
You have not completed Joel's
was
game
it the
this
same?
Week. It was higher.
Oh.
Monica Pui in 2016 got to a career high 27. In the world. So
this is by far my weakest game, I have to say. Joel's game is my nemesis.
Yes, two correct answers. But yes,
only two.
Failed at the third hurdle, yeah.
What was the next one? Can we have one more go?
I mean, I can give you the couple of other players I was going to go for. So the next one was going to be Bethany Mattek-Sands in singles.
Oh, this is tough, isn't it?
I think she... the same as Puig, would it have been?
I honestly don't know. Lower, I'd say lower.
It was going to be lower, yeah. That was at 30.
These are all very close together.
They're very close.
Hey, I wanted to make it challenging. And the final name I had to throw this one in there as a bit of a wild card, and this was for you, Kim, specifically. I put in everyone's favourite Spanish player, Pablo Andujar.
Oh, as just going off to ATP after
okay,
all the women.
Okay, so there's not... Joel's game doesn't have many rules.
He has been seeded, though, at Slam, I think. So I'd say his highest is like 31 or something.
Or do you think it's the same, then? Maybe Joel's finishing on the same.
Yeah,
we'll say the same.
Or 32 or something. Mm.
That's incorrect. Oh. No, it was. You are right, Kim, but he was 32. He was career high 32 Kim. In 2015. So there you go. There you go, indeed. That
Some
was Joel's
niche
game.
Knowledge there.
I quite enjoyed
Thank
that,
you very
actually.
Much.
I actually enjoyed it because it got Chris out of his comfort zone, it felt like.
I was definitely off my comfort zone from the off when I got it completely wrong. 10 ranking points off, and actually all of the players were within 10 ranking points. So clearly I was not going to do well. But good
More
game,
of Joel's
Joel.
Game,
yes,
please.
Good game.
Yes, good game. Thanks very much. Let's dig into the mailbag for this week because we have an email from Jessica who was asking us about the Netflix slam. So Jessica says, "Hi, Tennis Weekly. I would love to hear what you thought about the Netflix slam between Rafa Nadal and Carlos Alcaraz. Did you think it lived up to the billing?" Now, I wonder how many of our listeners will have seen the Netflix slam. You know, we have been talking about it a little bit on the podcast, and most, I mean, I don't know if most listeners have a Netflix subscription, whether they would have been able to access it, but I have watched it. Have you both tuned in? Did it lure you in on Sunday night?
I watched some of the highlights. I did not watch it live.
I don't have Netflix.
So I'm actually...
You don't have Netflix, Chris?
I was on my sister's account, I have to confess.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
yeah.
Dear.
Yeah.
But Kim, you watched it live, so I feel like we need to hear your kind of live interpretation of it first.
I didn't watch it live.
Oh,
I
was you didn't watch it live?
I was watching the UK darts final.
Oh, well, that's actually, I mean, that's very...
Which was very dramatic, the end to that. But then you could argue that the end of Rafa and Carlos was dramatic because it went to a champions tiebreak. But the UK darts was an actual tournament. So I thought, you know, an exhibition, you know that there's not really that much on the line. I also love how it went to that last set tiebreak or champions tiebreak. It's almost like once Rafa won the first set, you just knew he would lose the second because people have paid vast quantities of money to be there. They want to see more time on court, I'm sure.
Did you think it lived up to the billing?
I mean, it was very promotion-y for Netflix, as you can imagine. They've obviously put vast quantities of money into it. I would watch it if it was on again, I guess. Is that mark of whether it was successful or not? Would I watch it again as a viewer from home? I think I would. Obviously, Rafa was a big selling point for me as a big fan of his. They'd need to guarantee they're going to get like big household names if they want to do it again. That they seemed very keen to do it again.
I can imagine
it was
the
very kind of absolutely it was a very Americanized kind of spectacle, I suppose. They had a lot of other American sports stars there, a load of celebrities in the audience, so it was like a fun kind of vibe and a bit of match practice for the two of them. And yeah, ultimately I would give it maybe 6.5 out of 10.
A lot of money, you know, for 6.5 out of 10, I'd say.
If I was there in Vegas, yeah, on holiday watching it, maybe my experience as a live viewer, you know, would be
different. And if you had a private lesson with Rafa and Alcaraz beforehand. Yeah.
If I was a billionaire.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like because, you know, it's an exhibition, although it can be fun and entertaining, it's never the same as if that was a Grand Slam and everything
I mean, watching some of the highlights, it did feel like at times like a glorified practice session. The bit I loved most was actually the commentary and the presentation of it. I mean, they had Andy Roddick, Andre Agassi, who we don't, I feel, get a lot of on broadcast, and Jim Courier. So I feel like from that point of
good
view,
lineup.
I loved very
it was good.
Big blockbuster kind of lineup for the commentary, which I enjoyed. On court, I was not so sure because they didn't even have like what electronic line calling, and I don't think exhibition line judges are, I'm not going to cut them some slack because this was such a big money event. It almost felt like there was no budget left over for decent line umpires because it felt like there were lots of challenges going on.
Everyone loves a challenge though, Joel, don't they? For the audience,
I guess,
for that, a couple of dodgy calls just to get a few clapping
going.
I guess so.
I mean, maybe from an entertainment point of view. I think, you know, ultimately, you know, these events might not be for me, but if they're going to appeal to an audience that deliberately isn't me and it works, then good on it. I almost kind of want to wait and see what kind of the viewership numbers are, because there's no way they made money on this given the amount of money they were spending on players, commentary teams, getting Sam Querrey involved, no doubt. But if it draws in an audience and a new audience for tennis, then tennis is the winner and I would be happy with it.
Yeah, I think it was definitely aimed at a, you know, newer audience who are new to tennis. And I think it's just also part of Las Vegas. They seem to be, you know, they've had the F1 come there. They're just kind of a bit like Saudi Arabia, trying to lure all these sports there. So it's also kind of that kind of city image building as well. But yeah, I think it hasn't caused any harm, I would say. So we'll embrace it to some extent. I mean, let's talk about news from the tour. We have had the Simona Halep news, which, Chris, I know you've just been so eager for the last kind of 45
minutes. I'm just
going to
sit back in
to
my chair now and
to talk about
hear what Chris has
am I trying to convince? Is Kim going to give us a bit of background for the listeners?
I can do. So many listeners will know that Simona Halep has been currently serving a 4-year ban for alleged doping. A substance called Roxadustat was found in her system from a test. And there were also charges for irregularities in her athlete biological passport. She's been appealing and protesting her innocence, stating that it was, from a supplement that she didn't know that had this substance in. It's very much given to her as part of her move to the Mouratoglou Academy. But anyway, the case was heard by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, who have essentially reduced her ban from 4 years to 9 months, which means that she's already served that time. So she is available to return to tennis, professional tennis, as soon as possible. They partially upheld her case, stating that on the balance of probabilities, she had not taken Roxadustat intentionally. And that the ITIA, or another body, concluded that the contamination was likely to have come from a collagen supplement called Keto MCT. So Chris, what do you make of this announcement? Put your legal sports legal brain on, tell us.
So I think this will be quite a shock to many people, the nature of the reduction. I think we're very used to the Court of Arbitration for Sports and appeals to this court leading to reductions in the verdict and in the bans that happen. This has happened for Haddad Maia, who had a reduced sentence. Yastremska had a sentence that was overturned. Sharapova, very famously, had a reduced sentence. And that's probably the most pertinent case here, because what this does relate to is intention. And so when you talk about the balance of probabilities and the likely clause that's in a lot of the ITIA from the first kind of ruling, it is based on what is likely. And it has to be based on the evidence that's there. So this is ruled that she did not deliberately take it, is what they believe, and that it was contaminated. But because of the fact that the intention's been taken out of it and the blood passport irregularity has been thrown out, that's led to 9 months. So that is the explanation around that side of things. I do think that there is definitely some confusion from people, because I don't think this is a victory for clean sport. This is not a victory for a clean athlete. This is somebody, the only thing we know for sure is this was in their system. And I think that's something that people can forget, that when it comes to intention, two courts can find something to be different. It's not like it's a unanimous decision of 11 judges. It's actually three judges who have made some relatively questionable decisions in the past. One of the judges actually was on the Court of Arbitration for Sport panel at the 2022 Beijing Olympics that let kind of the 15-year-old Russian figure skater Kamila Valieva continue to compete, even though she had a pre-games positive test result, and then she was banned for 4 years. So there is this problem where you do see these verdicts like yo-yoing at times. And I think that is definitely a problem, that we do need consistency. But at the same time, I think it's very hard for people who are following the case to know what to make of this. And I think that's something where I think Joel, taking the position that you have, which is kind of like, just follow what's happening, see what happens. And then if she's playing again, that's great. But I do think kind of contaminated with kind of integrity, which is the line that she used on her post, I do think we've got a bit far with that. I think if I was her, I'd be celebrating the fact that the verdict was she did not intentionally dope. And I think that's the most important thing I would focus on for her. But I do think, for me, I'm not convinced. And that's not the podcast view. That's my personal view. That I do think if you don't have blood work that's done from April to September and there are irregularities in your blood passport, there's not enough evidence. And so I think that's what the ITA was saying. We do think that she probably was doing some sort of blood doping in this sense. But then the Court of Arbitration for Sport said, we're not sure that you can prove it. And I think that's the burden of evidence, and it wasn't reached.
I mean, it's amazing to me that the difference of what the ITIA, like the tennis drug governing body, have found and handed out, and what the Court of Arbitration of Sport have found and handed out is so different.
Poles apart.
Yeah, poles apart. And this is not the first example. It almost feels like any sort of tennis player who ever gets a ban handed to them from the ITIA, it's almost kind of like, I might as well appeal it, because the track record is that it's going to be greatly, greatly reduced. And I can't think that's a very good situation to be in, because if you're a player, you're almost kind of like, I don't really have any faith in my own tennis drug governing body, because, you know, CASA just kind of coming in and being like, well, you've said that, actually, we don't agree, and we're going to reduce it, and reduce it, like, in some situations, like with Simona Halep, quite drastically so. So I think for me, it's put a real spotlight on these different governing bodies out there and how they interpret information differently, and these results and findings that come out that, as you said, Chris, just feel poles apart, when actually they should be more consistent and there should be some sort of unity there, because, you know, at the moment, as I say, it doesn't feel like players can go about their career with the confidence that, I guess, that it's you know, with the confidence of the ITIA kind of, you know, following them, because they just end up with these really long sentences that ultimately just always get reduced.
Exactly. And I think that,
or even struck off.
Yeah, exactly. Or struck off in the case of Tara Moore, but they're now appealing the strike off in that sense from the ITIA. But I think that is a big point, because also the spin that players will always have, irrespective of guilt, I'm not saying that any one of these players are guilty, but then the narrative is that the ITIA was not the correct one, you know, is that they were pushing for too much, and that you always should go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport that gave you a favourable ruling. I think one thing that we can all agree on is that this took too long.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think partly it does make me think that maybe if the ITIA does suspect that someone is doping, they know it will get reduced. So therefore, they did drag it out potentially. This could be an argument that you see with what Simona was saying, because if it drags out, then you are effectively serving a ban, even if your ban gets reduced, because she could have played from last July. So it is a weird one, because it has been reduced to 9 months, but she has served longer than that. So again, that's very confusing. And when it comes...
It's scary, because, you know, for some of these players, it's like this could be a retirement sentence, effectively.
It definitely could be.
On the flip side, if, you know, you can't let that person carry on whilst the investigations are ongoing, you know, you can't let them carry on playing, because if they were to win tournaments, there would just be so much question, you know, so many question marks, unfair on everyone else. So I think, you know, it's right to suspend, investigate, and have an initial thing. But yeah, I agree. It should go to the higher body faster if someone's appealing. I think definitely it shows all these cases that you should absolutely appeal if you're the player. Don't just take what the first sort of decision is. I mean, if you can obviously pay the legal costs of said appeals.
I mean, I think that's another challenge, because, you know, you probably have some players who might go through this process and they might not have as deeper pockets as someone like a Simona Halep to
Ema,
kind of go
example.
Through all of the... Yeah, he retired, didn't he?
He did,
yes. It was kind of like maybe he didn't feel like that option was available to him, even though, and as I say, kind of looking back on it, it's almost like it's going to happen if you've got the... You know, it's going to get reduced if you have the money.
It's more favourable. I think, I mean, sort of the final thing that I'll say on this is that as someone who has followed it closely, there are a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense. There are a lot of questions we still have about certain things that have been written. The full report will be coming out. And I think that maybe there will be more clarity there. But do I think that tennis is clean? I do not. I think a lot of people don't think it's clean. And this was obviously a very high profile sort of doping case. And so I think that it will be interesting to see the reception that Halep has coming back to the tour, because, for example, with Sharapova and with other players who are welcome back, there is quite often not necessarily open arms for them, because
Eugenie Bouchard.
Exactly. And you do know that someone had.
She's a cheater.
Exactly. Perfect impression there. You love bringing that one out. Yeah. But no, I think that would be interesting, because I think all we know is something's been in her system. And do I think that we can definitively say whether someone's intention was or wasn't? And when you have two conflicting reports that say something completely opposed to each other, you don't know. So the positive thing, Simona Halep fans will be rejoicing. And having someone who can play tennis as well as Simona Halep back on the tour is always going to be interesting.
Well, I was just going to ask you both about that, because, you know, her ranking is going to be down. It's not like she can come back, I think, with a protected ranking. What do you think the situation is going to be with, like, wildcards, for example, and tournament organisers, and looking at this news and how it's broken out, and, you know, umming and ahhing on whether potentially to give maybe Simona Halep a wildcard to their event? What are your kind of opinions on like that situation, and is she almost kind of too hot of a commodity and a talking point and all of that stuff to sort of be like, no, we don't need that? Or do you think it's like she's served her time and let's get back on a tennis court?
I mean, it might depend on the moral decision making of those in charge, or maybe other tournaments will kind of do a watch and wait, okay, and see how she's perceived at the first event she comes back to, or how well ticket sales do, you know, that, though they sort of how much attention it gets in the media. I think I can see her getting wild cards. You know, she is a Grand Slam champion. And, you know, if we take what the Court of Arbitration say, you know, there isn't enough proof to say she'd definitely willingly doped, and therefore, you know,
exactly,
we'll agree with that and go forward.
Exactly. Yeah. What reason would you have not to, given the fact that they've said the intention was that she didn't dope? Now that's the official line. And also, she's Simona Halep. Business is business. You'd want her to be at your tournament. So I think if I was a tournament director, I'd be giving her a wild card, and I might even put her on the poster. Like, who knows if you really need to, because it is a business, as we talked about. And I think we're about to talk about that now as well.
Yes, talking of business, Saudi Arabia, we talked earlier about their kind of new partnership with the ATP, but essentially, yeah, ATP, they have announced a multi-year strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund. So this just kind of continues the investment that the Saudi Arabia government are investing into tennis. They are also having on-court sponsorship. So, you know, big tour events like Miami, Madrid, Beijing, it's going to have Saudi public investment fund, PIF, as a major sponsor. Interestingly, the LTA turned down that opportunity for some of the grass court events, including Queens and Eastbourne. So they didn't want to go fully for that on-court sponsorship. And this comes on top of the existing announcement that the Saudi Arabia will be hosting the
next gen finals
for the next 5 years. Obviously, the first edition we had last year, at the back end of last year, we've had a host of other players sign up for exhibitions there as well. So this is, you know, not a surprise. It's very much part of a continuing trend. You mentioned also, obviously, Rafa is now an ambassador for the Saudi Arabian Tennis Federation. I guess it depends how you look at this. You know, are we looking at it from a very cynical, you know, reason? Are we really fully believing their kind of corporate marketing when they say they want to, you know, foster inclusivity and all of that? You know, or is it just for them, it's about getting their name out there, and, you know, the human rights kind of side of their country is just being washed to the side of this kind of sports washing? Joel, what's your immediate interpretation of this news?
I think it was inevitable. And I'm always happy, I guess, you know, having money coming in to help grow the sport is a plus. I think when you look at kind of the PIF's involvement with other sports and how at times it has been very hostile, for example, you know, with LIV Golf, I see this as a bit more like, actually, they've learned from that experience, and they're not kind of coming in fully on, like, almost kind of fully head on and being like, we want to take over tennis. Actually, they're almost kind of more, it's a bit more kind of soft and transitional, and feels like they're working their way in. It's a more of a stepping stone, it's more of a build, and they're actually working, you know, with these you know, the governing bodies, as opposed to almost being their enemy. So I think from that point of view, it's nice. And I think it was interesting to hear you know, John Wertheim, who's a tennis reporter and broadcaster, he reported the number over the 5-year contract as $100 million. But actually, I don't think that's that much. I feel like for kind of Saudi Arabia, like they've dealt with bigger numbers in other sports, but certainly for me, I think like it's a stepping stone, and it's being done in a way that showed that they have learned, I think, from golf. And we can't get away from the fact that it's inevitable. So I'm almost kind of like, we're just going to have to embrace it, whether we like it or not.
Embrace it or accept it would be sort of the question that I have there. I think, as you say, the multi-year strategic partnership, I'm not sure what that means. It does sound like a soft launch, doesn't it? I'm like, it's very intangible that the logo is popping up, they're sponsoring the rankings. It's almost like they said...
Is it sort of like a Trojan horse type situation?
I feel like it might be, you know.
That's the worry, isn't it?
That I think after the 5 years, maybe there will be opportunities for them to invest more during those 5 years. But it does feel like maybe the ATP have said, look, we can't give you headline sponsor year one, so let's see how it's received.
And earn your corn first.
Exactly.
All, yeah.
But I do think, and I do like the fact that, you know, the LTA, Queens and Eastbourne were offered, and they did turn it down, because I think that is something that does speak volumes. I'm not always a fan of some of the decisions of kind of British tennis. Have made, obviously, around kind of the banning of players at Wimbledon that happened, but obviously that was Wimbledon that made that decision.
I mean, I guess it's sort of easier from an LTA's point of view, because we know, I mean, we see their financials every
year. They don't
year.
Need They're the so, money. Yeah.
They don't need the money. And that raises the point I was going to bring on next, was the WTA. You spoke about the inequality in prize money distribution at 500 level between San Diego and Acapulco. WTA is very much an organization that does need the money. So to both of you, what do you feel like, it's inevitable that Saudi Arabia are going to be investing in the WTA further down the line, or what do you think is going to happen there?
I mean, the situation of women in Saudi Arabia is different to the situation of men there, which makes it more complicated in terms of, you know, is it right for the WTA? But I think there might have to be an element of, we'll just willfully tolerate them investing if it means our players are going to get the prize money they kind of need and deserve. And what I would argue as a sort of bit of a devil's advocate is that other sponsors of the WTA and ATP Tour in the past, you know, various corporate entities, have we looked into their, you know, human rights records? Are they using, you know, modern day slavery? Are they, you know, having human rights issues in other parts of the world where they operate? I'm not saying any of them have, of course, and I'm sure there's a certain amount of kind of checks on these, but I'm sure other sponsors in the past may have had question marks, you know, not into the same extent as the Saudi Arabia public investment fund, but I guess that no sponsor is probably perfect, is what I'm trying
when
to say.
When you get into that kind of money, I mean, no one's squeaky clean. So I think arguably, as you say, money talks, tennis is a business, and the ATP are taking a business opportunity. And unfortunately, at some point, the WTA will have to, whether that's with the end of season finals or whether that's kind of a multi-year strategic partnership, you know, whatever the wording might be, it's a business. And at the moment, the WTA isn't being run as an effective business. So this sort of investment would make a big difference to women's tennis, even if it isn't necessarily the best thing to be associated with the women's tennis platform.
I think you're right, Chris, in terms of, like, earlier you spoke about, like, we almost need that, you know, the ATP and WTA collaboration to continue happening, and they almost need to form some sort of super name that is almost gender neutral or doesn't kind of evoke male or female. It just evokes tennis as kind of a neutral organization. And as you said, then it feels like the money can come into that organization and it's almost like tennis wins.
Exactly. And I think joint decisions and more consistency across rulings in the Rublev case, in the Simona Halep case. We want consistency, and we want there to be kind of an equality that exists that currently doesn't in a lot of these different decisions and rulings that we've seen.
I mean, sport and tennis is a bit of a microcosm for the rest of life, isn't it? But there's some potentially long-term decisions that will be made in this arena. But let's have a look at what is happening in the here and now, because that's
predictions time, isn't it, as well?
The present moment. Indian Wells is upon us. Yeah, the draw is kicking off. We've had qualifying. I think the Brits have all lost in qualies, Harriet Dart, Liam Brody, etc. But we do have the draw, and we will be looking through it and making some predictions. So let's do the men first. Novak Djokovic is back as the top seed, and obviously Alcaraz second seed, Sinner and Medvedev third and fourth seeds. Any particular elements of the draw that stand out, or do we want to go straight into predictions?
I mean, Nadal's listeners. Back, Kim.
Oh, yes.
He's got Raonic in first round. I mean, that's a tie straight out of, what, 2008?
Yeah, it's quite old school. Yeah, Rafa.
He's only 33, though, Raonic. I couldn't believe that. That was really surprising to me.
So he's still got a good 4 years on Rafa.
Yeah.
They're both on projected rankings. Yes, and the winner of that will play Holger Rune. So that could be an interesting one. But Rafa is back. No, I'm obviously very grateful for that. He's, I think, due to play tomorrow, the sort of Thursday night match. Novak Djokovic, on the other hand, is going for a sixth title here.
First time he's been back since 2019, I believe. I've read that, and which seems almost extraordinary that he's won six titles, given the fact that he hasn't been back. And I was going to say, someone else who's in that sort of generation, I was very surprised when the wild cards were announced. Fabio Fognini was given a wild card. Fognini, sorry, I always get that wrong. And I just thought that was so surprising. So he's playing Zapata Morales in round one with an opportunity to play against Baez in round two. And I don't know where that wild card came from. But
surely there's an American player, you know, home hope that they could have gone for instead.
Is it the Saudi investment fund? Have they put him in there?
Who knows?
They've got a thing for
Fabio.
Yeah,
they do.
So Joel, who have you got for quarter one?
Djokovic Rude.
Oh, okay. I've got Djokovic Hurkacz. Chris?
I've gone for Umber versus Rude. I've just thought...
Ooh, who's Djokovic losing to?
Umber, of course.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
He's
played a lot of tennis. Not much of it outdoors, though, I have to say. So I'm not too confident. But I just thought, Joel, you're backing him as well. I think you should have probably put your money where your mouth is on that one.
That's probably true, actually, yeah.
Also, I have just realised, yeah, apologies. Hurkacz is the eighth seed, not Rude. Rude
it's very
has
close. He's ninth.
Down. Yes, easily done. Quarter two, Joel.
Medvedev, Fritz.
You love Fritz. You honestly do.
Fritz has had a good start to the season.
He won a 250.
I mean, he lost first round last week, but I also have gone for Fritz, though, because he did win this title previously.
You didn't see that before you spoke, did you, Kim?
And I've gone for Dimitrov over Medvedev,
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, because he's had an all right year. I just kind of had some vibes about him.
I've gone Medvedev, Rune.
Well, you always go for
Rune.
Yeah,
pretty much.
I suppose. And quarter three, Joel?
Rublev, Sinner.
I've gone for exactly the same.
I'm channeling my inner Kim. I'm going Lehechka, Sinner.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Do you think Rublev's going to self-combust before then?
I'm curious to see what his on-court behavior is like in Indian Wells. And see,
maybe
see
he'll just be like shaking hands and waving at line judges.
Yeah,
and
he's going to go on like a peace mission. Give peace
them some Rublev.
Yeah. Free Rublev to line judges.
Yeah.
Quarter four, Joel.
I've got Alex de Minaur versus Karen Khachanov.
Oh, I've gone for exactly the same. Snap.
You're very in sync, aren't you?
Chris?
I've gone for Alex de Minaur and I've gone for Alcaraz. I'm backing Alcaraz to make at least the quarters.
Alcaraz, really? Really?
So me and Joel are dismissing Alcaraz.
I'm
we don't think he's
going to... I really hope
I think he's dropping... I mean, he's defending Chang. I think he's going to be dropping big points here.
Okay.
Let's see who we've got in our semis, Joel.
Djokovic, Fritz, Sinner, Khachanov.
Oh, okay. I've got Djokovic, Dimitrov, Sinner, Alex de Minaur. Chris?
I have one of the same as you. I've got Sinner, Alex de Minaur in my second semi, and I've got a battle of the Scandinavians, because I loved watching that the other week, of Rude versus Rune. Can you tell that I'm based in Scandinavia? Maybe.
Yeah, I know. You're very pro-Scandi. There we go.
Wozniacki's winning the women.
Spoiler. And the final, Joel? Well, final annual champion, please.
I've got Djokovic Sinner in the final, and I'm going with Jannik Sinner. I think Jannik Sinner. He's the form player this year. I can't not back him, so I'm going Jannik Sinner.
You think he's going to continue his
Sinner winner
start to the
Palm
year?
Palm Springs.
Ooh, that has a ring to it. Well, I've gone Djokovic Sinner for the final, but I have gone for Djokovic. Just old habits die hard. Chris?
I think Casper's making another hard court final and not winning. I think he's going to lose to Sinner in the final.
So we've got two Sinners and a Djokovic for our champions. Listeners, let us know what you think. And I'm sure we'll be posting these on social media so you can lay into them as well if you like. But let's look at the women's draw. Iga Świątek is the top seed. We've got Sabalenka, Rybakina. Everyone seems to be here, which is great. And it's interesting to see how some recent champions might get on. Like, we've got, you know, Jasmine Paolini, Katie Balter.
She's got a rough draw opening up. Katie Balter, Camilla Giorgi. Very interested to see how that goes. Also, Danielle Collins. I posted this on the WhatsApp chat. I swear Danielle Collins just perennially plays Iga Świątek in like round one or round two of every tournament that they play in. Because in Indian Wells, again, if Collins comes through a qualifier in round round one, she plays Iga Świątek.
It's almost the same, isn't it?
Also may well play Noskova.
It's AO part two.
This is just a continuation. But let's go by quarter then. I mean, Świątek is aiming to win her second title here. Rybakina is trying to defend her title. And obviously Sabalenka hasn't had a great return since winning the AO this year. So there's a lot to kind of play for, obviously. Quarter by quarter, I'm going to come to you first, Chris. Quarter one.
I've gone for Świątek Ostapenko.
Joel?
Świątek Kerber. No, I'm joking. Świątek versus Ostapenko.
Kerber is up right
now.
You
never know.
She is.
Kerber might.
Oh, is she? Okay.
Kerber might beg to differ. I've gone for Świątek Ostapenko, though, so we are a clean sweep for that one. Woohoo!
She's just got her nails done in Riga Nails, I think. I think I saw that earlier. So, yeah, I think that's a good sign.
She's ready.
Quarter two, Chris.
Joel's going to make fun of me for this, but I'm going Pavlyuchenkova every time.
You love
you do like
she's having such a good season, so underrated. Yeah. And Rybakina, I've got those two here.
And Joel,
yeah, can't not defending champion Rybakina versus Haddad Maia.
Of course, Joel.
Okay.
Of course,
yeah. I've gone for Rybakina against Daria Saville.
There's always one rogue
which
prediction.
Which is my rogue.
Never two, always one.
Why not? Chris, quarter three?
I went Azarenka Goff in this section.
Joel?
Goff Kasatkina.
Oh, I've gone with Chris, Azarenka Goff for this one.
Okay.
I think Vika's going to get to at least the quarters. Quarter four, Chris?
I was struggling to find someone in the top half of quarter four. I went for Sakkari. I'm not convinced at all.
I'm not convinced either.
I did not know who to pick. I thought Fernandez might be injured, so I would have gone for her. But then I went for Sakkari Sabalenka.
Chris? I mean, sorry, Joel.
I'll say it again. Sakkari Sabalenka.
So I didn't believe you on the Sakkari.
A chance to change my mind.
I don't think Sabalenka's making the quarters. I've got Garcia versus Svitolina.
You're on the Svitolina train now as well.
Jeb's life's coming back at Indian Wells, and Svitolina's getting to the quarters.
I would love to see Garcia get there. I hope you're right, Joel. I went for Fernandez, injury or not, and Sabalenka.
Much better prediction. Yeah,
two rogue ones.
They played each other
at
that US Open, right? Fernandez got to the final.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was very, very well played from Fernandez. Okay. Another match Sabalenka should have won.
Semis then, Chris.
Surely we can agree it will be Świątek Rybakina.
Yeah, I've got that.
Yeah, I've got that
agreed.
As well for the first one.
I want that.
Semi two?
What has Joel got? Has he got Kasatkina versus BHM?
It could be rogue, but I haven't gone that rogue. But I have gone Goff Garcia, which is still rogue given. I mean, Goff did not have a very good Middle Eastern swing, and Garcia... Yeah.
She's got a podcast.
Not sure. Not sure. She's got a podcast.
She's got a podcast with an
Goff
episode.
Goff Garcia.
I went for Goff Sabalenka for the second one.
And I went for Azarenka Sabalenka. So we're kind of versions of the same. Yeah.
Okay. So what's our final and champion, Chris?
I went for a very boring 1v2 with one winning. So I had Świątek winning that one.
Over Sabalenka.
Indeed.
Okay, I've got Świątek versus Goff, with Świątek winning. Both of my champions of the number one seed, so I'm also accused me of being boring there. And Joel?
Świątek Goff. With Coco Goff winning, she's going to find some form in
Indian
Wells.
Joel, we may not
she's
have...
She's taking the title.
We may not
it
have...
It happens every time, I predict.
No, we may not have...
She's on the cover of Vogue, which is exciting.
I mean, she's already won
it's
there.
A sign.
So,
it's a sign.
we don't have a... this isn't a slam spoon
Vogue
of
champion.
Shame. It might be like a master's fork of shame that you might get. I'm not sure what it would be. The wooden spoon.
A cocktail stirrer for the sunshine double cocktail.
Yes, you can use that on your next vacation.
Yes. Oh, well, we'll see. We'll see. Yes, it's all very exciting. We've got Indian Wells over the next couple of weeks. But we're going to wrap up our latest tour catch up there, listeners. I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action to come from the ATP and WTA tours.
We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. So if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You can also follow us on social media or email the show. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and X. And the handle for all of those is Tennis Weekly Pod. You can purchase our wonderful Tennis Weekly merch at etsy.com/shop/tennisweeklypodcast. You can email us for the mailbag at tennisweeklypod@gmail.com, or do check out our website, tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we are going to be back a week on Monday at Tennis Weekly HQ. So we've had a bumper episode today, and we are going to be back a week on Monday. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Kim.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.